You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. I'm speaking with Sam Sachs at the Mechanics Institute Library and Chess Room, 57 Post Street. Thank you for joining me, Sam.
So glad to be here.
Sam, I'd like you to grab one of those pieces of paper and read me a poem.
I've got one in my head. Is that okay?
That works better.
It's like 2 minutes. Would you prefer a shorter poem?
No.
All right.
You go for 2 minutes on memory. I'm stoked.
Oh, I'm going to do a half hour later tonight.
Okay.
When I die, I wonder which of my friends will choose to participate in the television movie. Oh yes, there will be a television movie. Though they'd probably prefer a documentary so they can play themselves, my friends. They're really good at playing themselves. My friends want more screen time. My friends will make money off of me after I die. This is how I know they are my friends. When I die, swap bucket, bruised ankle, dance, sex, post lip, sucking off a cigarette, guts, breaking guts, bending guts, howling crowds, fingernails, growing at the precise speed of sound when I die. Deal with whatever I leave behind as you will. Give my shirts with collars away, leave the rest for some landfill. Stretch my poems across 100 billboards between New York City and hell, convincing people to keep driving forward when I die. Bury me in your pocket. Write an epithet for my epitaph on your underpants. Choose to remember me or not. Either way, I'll still brush against your thigh as you walk. I always did call you a coffin. When I die, I hope they lie about me. Call me all the things they called me when I was alive. When I die, I hope they tell the truth about me. How I didn't drink as much as I write. How I didn't drink enough. How I didn't write too much. How I screamed poems at drywall and called that writing. Pounding my chest into a bruised alphabet. I know there will never be no television movie. I know I won't be stretched out along any highway to nowhere. I know there won't be no curbside memorial concert starring all of my friends, confusing their bodies for wind instruments, spilling out their whiskey on purpose. When a friend who I knew but did not know walked off that bridge straight into her last stanza, they didn't do sh. I didn't do sh. Just had another drink. We talked about writing. The most important things do not know words. I wonder what her exhale sounded like as she fell. Pole dancing lightning bug, tornado coffee cup, the slice of scissor against shrieking hair. I wonder what water feels like when it takes on the properties of concrete for a moment. A body blooming crimson on its surface, then wilting into the deep. The most important things do not know words. So when I fall, like some Arizona politician, like some Egyptian government, like some girl off a bridge, I know there won't be enough ink left in all of the pens to help me breathe on my own again. I know that books and mausoleums are only built by those who value remembering, and I know that this is just another bad poem stolen from the American Book of the Dead.
Sam Sachs, that was incredible. What's the title of that poem? Does it have one?
Oh, it doesn't. No, that's one of my newer poems. I haven't put a title on it yet.
That's remarkable.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like you to talk about writing that. That seems like, as you spoke it from memory, It seems like something that it might have been written, as you described in the poem, shouting poetry at drywall.
Well, I mean, that's the process for most of my writing, right? It's like walking around the city and talking to myself, and eventually something develops out of that. This was written more as an elegy for a friend who was part of like the writing community that I'm a part of, who ended up killing herself recently. And it's sort of like a response to how we all dealt with that death and how we dealt with that tragedy. And I think the difference between elegy and exploitation in writing,
That's an interesting observation. Could you talk, now, did you write any of this down?
Yeah, I wrote that poem. Usually I go through and I like write it over and over again.
So let me get a grip on your process. So when you're walking around and talking, do you record yourself?
Phrases and ideas that stick with me will eventually go into a notebook, and that'll eventually go onto a typewriter or a computer, and then that eventually becomes a poem. And then once it's written down, I have it memorized and I speak it, and then it's edited in my mouth. So, you know, like whatever feels natural comes out of that.
It's really quite remarkable. I mean, your performance, one of the things that interests me about the way that poem was written was the writing is in part performance. And I'd like you to talk about performing things live, what you just spoke here,
right.
that don't come off the paper necessarily. How do you, as an artist, how do you cope with that? I mean, you did things here that, as remarkable as that poem is to see, I'm sure, written, it's not going to be the same thing.
Well, that transition for me is like a pretty difficult one. I just finished my first poetry manuscript and trying to bridge the gap between, you know, like spoken poetics and performative poetics and like something you read is a large chasm. Like I come out of like a performative tradition. Like I started writing poems mostly when I was touring with my friends. I went on like a year and a half tour around the United States and Canada at poetry shows in basements and, you know, rooftops and alleyways and stuff and whatever show we could get. And from there, you know, I learned like that when you're reading your poems, it's like a performative act. People are watching you and listening to you and responding to how your body and voice and your intonation and all of that sort of like affect them. Yeah. And so I guess now looking at how it's written, yeah, I don't know. I used to like make hip-hop records and I wrote plays and stuff, so I think a lot of my writing comes out of that tradition.
Well, it strikes me too that if you're looking for an audience for this, you know, we live in an age where it used to be where it was really, really difficult to market and move around and get to an audience, a sound recording or a video recording. I mean, just the technology and production, you know, to produce a VHS videotape, for example, or even just a record back in the 30s, that required essentially a huge factory and a major industry behind you. Now you can do all that yourself. So I think it seems to me that, especially speaking to you and hearing you, that you're changing the parameters of this kind of performance in that you could market just as easily as you can sell your manuscript in a book. You could also, it wouldn't cost you more than 10 cents more to include a CD of your performance.
Yeah, well, what I've been doing recently is I had a website and then I would give people, like sell people links to it if they wanted, or just give CDs out for free. Because those are really cheap to reproduce. But like YouTube and internet clips and stuff is like a great way to spread like performance poetics across the United States. Like I spend so much of my time listening to poets from around the world on, you know, the internet.
With the old model, the Ezra Pounds and the T.S. Eliots, I mean, they were actually able to make a living at this stuff. This is not necessarily the case now, and I'm wondering what you think the future is of art when, if there's essentially there's no money in it. Let's just say you're never gonna make a friggin' dime on it.
Well, yeah, this is true.
How I mean, just because not as a reflection of the quality,
right.
Just because the means by which it is distributed is digital, so it's so easily replicated, it's impossible to control the reproduction. One copy out there can, in 10 days, be copied across the World Wide Web, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it.
Right. Well, I think the easiest I had sustaining myself was when I was on tour with three other people, and we were able to live completely off of our art for like a year, living
really?
In a Saturn. There was like travel costs and food and lodging and stuff. I think mostly that's because we would be going to new cities and like pulling new audiences in and building that way. Being in San Francisco and trying to make, like I got fired from this barista job a while back for various reasons. At shows, you know, maybe I'll make $50 on like a really good night, at readings, and like I do readings like 3 or 4 times a week usually, and I go to poetry shows almost every night, and I'm trying to, you know, build up this community the best I can and ingratiate myself to it. But yeah, no, it's definitely not sustainable paying rent.
Talk about who your influences are. I mean, you said you come out of a hip-hop tradition, but I heard a lot of other stuff in there, at least from my perception. That's not, maybe I'm just an old fogey who hears T.S. Eliot and Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, well, let me clarify. I guess, like, when I was talking about coming out of a hip-hop tradition, like, I just used to MC, you know, and I used to, like, when I was in high school, I would, like, battle. You know, by the wall where we would smoke cigarettes. And so I think that's like the performative tradition that I'm sort of connecting to. Writers that influenced me, like the first book of poems that really just messed my head up was called Ceremonies by Essex Hemphill, who's really just an amazing writer. And he sort of addresses queerness and desire in poems that have like, that has sort of rocked my head and like reframed how I, you know, how I view narrative and how I view, you know, specifically like personal narrative in literary forms, and like the potential that there is there. Other writers, I mean, yeah, like I love Ginsberg. He's great. Well, some of his work, he's a little too prolific for his own good, in my experience. But yeah, I'm, like most recently, I'm just connecting to the 90s poetics in San Francisco that has all but disappeared, you know, because there's no, you know, historical memory really when it comes to poets who don't become canonized. So like David Lerner and whatever, Sparrow 13 Laughing Wand, all those writers, with this just sort of like raw and gritty aesthetic that connects to this 90s mission poetry, sort of
the old Bukowski style.
Yeah.
Talk about when you're performing, How much do you edit yourself even when you're doing a live performance? Are you right creating as you perform?
Yeah, well, I think it depends. Like most of my poems are written, you know, and are structured, but there's always room for exploration within like the performance moment, like the moment of the performance. And so, like commenting on the room and the space and trying to build it up as this like ceremony, almost like something that we're all engaging in, and making it an event that isn't, you know, just sitting down and at a boring literary event, which is most of what I end up going to, is people reading their poems and like not really connecting with the emotional truth that they had found when they were writing it, but instead just speaking like a dead language. I think like being able to be present in the moment of performance and to connect with people who came, you know, they left their houses and their computers and, you know, whatever else, what other comforts they have at home to come listen to you speak poems. Like that's a really gorgeous concept. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's a lot of work to get your lazy ass out of the
house. For sure. Yeah. You owe people something special.
Now, one of the things I really liked about the poem was, and you were talked a little bit about this, was your sense of narration and storytelling. I think that's a really beautiful story in that poem, and I think it comes out really nicely. So I'd like you to talk about pacing your story in poetry, because there's a definite story in there, and we hear that story, but your revelation of it is slow and interesting, and you use the poetic form to do storytelling in a way I've not really heard necessarily.
Well, I mean, I think that mostly comes from, like, the repetition of that is from reading a lot of David Lerner, like, with the consistent refrain that builds. And I think slam has really helped me understand narrative and storytelling, because that tends to be what wins slam, you know, people telling their own stories, like their own tragic narratives or their own like experiences with overcoming oppression or whatever. I mean, often it's like very simplistic or often it's like not that interestingly crafted. But I think like the evolution of narrative for me has mostly been connected to slam. Also, like my friend Kim Johnson, who's like a really amazing writer, works with collage in ways that have been really effective, I think, where you can. And this other poet in Ohio, I'm blanking on his name, but he'll just throw streams of images at you and allow you to sort of build your own narrative out of that. Just like these juxtaposing, just crazy ideas.
Music with samples in it. The Ennio sample. Do you have another poem you can read me?
Sure. What's the word with cursing on here?
It's my blog, so you can just say whatever you want. And we should...
Oh, cool. Hmm. A poem, sorry. Okay, this is for my neighborhood, the Mission District in San Francisco. I saw an octopus pregnant with television wires clinging to the side of a brick building. A man blows his shofar into the hollow of a dumpster, and a car filled with nothing but light drives through darkness. Most times, this world does not make sense. At the corner of Alabama and Cesar Chavez, there is a contradiction. A condominium made of skin crawling out the pavement, growing towards the shadow of police lights, eating oxygen and the freshest vegetables from the corner store. The structure's key cornerstone is a human tooth covered in gold, mined by the hands of 49ers still wet with the blood of newly Spanish mouths. There is a mural in an alleyway that portrays this monster of capitalism lurking in foundations, claiming buildings for limbs and pigs' revolvers for tongues that breathe dollar sign and speak eviction. In this wet dream of gentrification, I wake covered in my sweat, shame-stained bedsheets, wash them clean daily before work. At the intersection of hipster and human, there is a dance hall made from the body of a converted Nazi bunker. At night, German children dance their grandparents' dances to music made by the descendants of Auschwitz. Now, the Bible tells us it took white Jesus 7 days to colonize San Francisco. At the intersection of hipster and human, there is a dance hall made from the body of an old Spanish church, of a methadone clinic, of a Santeria ritual site. At night, white children fill its belly with black music and dance whiskey lullabies to bedlam. Children, dressed in their grandparents' prejudice, press dollar bills into the barrels of riot cop guns, then run home, safe as a house, to plant flowers in the mouths of gated gardens. It is here. I saw a church bell shaped like a fist, a Molotov press conference occupying the silence of a repossessed stairwell, and a car filled with nothing but police light profiled in darkness. Most times this world, it does not make sense. At the corner of Alabama and Cesar Chavez, there is a contradiction. I live here on a border's edge, paying a border's rent for four walls and a floor as dirty as my mind is at night. My neighborhood is a beehive filled with high fructose corn syrup. It is a syringe injected into the limb of a city park tree, a pair of duct tape handcuffs placed on the mouth of a river, paying dowry to this hungry city that never lets it sleep.
I've been speaking with Sam Sachs. He's a poet who will be performing at Quiet Lightning tonight. That was amazing, Sam. Thank you very much.
Me. This was such a pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.